nice at work to be able to tell people at work, Happy Thanksgiving. You know, that was nice to be able to do that. We got to do that for one day out of the year, the day before Thanksgiving. You got to say those things to one another. Where the holiday we're about to enter into, that goes on for 4 weeks, and it goes on and on and on and on. You know, 2 years ago I spoke on the development of Christmas from the time of Christ forward, and about how the church fathers chose the pagan symbols of the day to substitute the days that looked Jewish to many Gentile Christians. And we talked about how anti-Semitism worked its way into the church, and how because the Jews were being persecuted by the Romans, the Christians didn't want to look Jewish, so they did whatever they could to not look Jewish. And if that meant doing away with the holy days, doing away with the Sabbath, and adopting a whole new holiday system, then so be it. And it caused a lot of strife in the early days of the church. One of the first battles that happened within the church was the fight over which day they kept Passover. And Passover was the first fight, but it eventually worked its way through the Sabbath and all the other holy days. And eventually, the church went through a sort of metamorphosis to resemble the churches of today and not the church of the first century. Last year I didn't cover the topic, but over the last year I've been thinking a lot about some of the conversations I've had with some people at work, some people within the faith here, and people I just meet out in the public. And, you know, when we think about dealing with people, coping with this holiday that goes on for so long, and sometimes people deal with it by sort of the ostrich approach. I'm going inside, and I'm going to stay inside until it's over, and let me know when it's done. But we can't always do that. We have to be out there. Our kids have to go to school. And I totally remember those days in the church growing up in school where it seemed like the elementary school teachers had no idea about curriculum other than let's make it about whatever holiday is around the corner. And that's what they would plan. And we would have weeks and weeks of the next holiday coming up. And so I totally understand what that's like to grow up in the church that way. For us in work, we have a number of issues at work. Sometimes they have secret Santas. They have Christmas parties. I told you last year about, or the year before, about an opportunity I had to attend a class on getting along at work. And I was given the scenario to talk about trying to make people get along by the fact that they wanted to have an office Christmas party, and there was some employee that didn't want to keep Christmas, and how as a supervisor I would handle that to make sure that everyone felt included. And I remember going over that with you and talking about that. And we each of us in our own ways have to deal with this and to cope with this. Today many Christians are learning about the origins of their most sacred of holidays and are asking themselves many of the same questions. Some use the phrase, put Christ back in Christmas. And of course, we've read in the Good News and other places that Christ was never in Christmas, so how can you put him back into Christmas? But, you know, some of the people that are saying these things, they're not saying this to be vindictive. They're not saying this to attack anyone. They're sincere people trying their best to keep what they think is a holiday that points them to God. And so it's to this topic and this reason that I sort of directed this sermon. As we try to cope with Christmas, how do we deal with people that are sincere? How do we deal with people that really want what's best for themselves, even though they want Christmas? You know, I've been studying a number of books, and one of them I've been studying is called 4,000 Years of Christmas. And, of course, if Jesus Christ lived 2,000 years ago, then what was being celebrated for 2,000 years before that? And to me, the most impressive quote I got out of the book wasn't between the covers at all. It was actually a dedication written on the inside flap. The book was given as a gift back in 1948. And on the inside cover, it says 1948. And it had this inscription on the inside. And it said, Happy birthday and Merry Christmas to Esther from Ed, Geneva, and John. So here's a book dedicated to dismantling the myth of Christmas. And it was given as a birthday slash Christmas gift to somebody in 1948. And I think, how can Christians today keep the day after reading a book like that? And it's really been on my mind how to approach sincere people. How to approach people that maybe their minds are open to the truth, and maybe there is a way to approach them. The problem with dealing with people like this is we have to realize that Christmas holds the imagination, and it holds the attention of people like no other day in the year. The title for today's sermon is Coping with the Magic of Christmas. Christmas has captured the imaginations of the world, and that only gives lip service to the worship of God. For most people, Christmas is a great celebration and nothing more. And even though I grew up in a household that had a Christian background, I was telling my parents a couple weeks ago, and I said, you know, I know we were religious in some respects, and both my mother and father had a religious background. But I said, you know, we kept Christmas until I was 8 years old, and I don't remember it ever being about God. And they said, because it was never about God for us. It was always about the presents. And they said, yeah, we were terrible. All we cared about was the tree, the presents, you know, what we were going to get you kids each year. That was the only thing on their mind. We didn't look at any religious angles to it whatsoever, even though my family would have claimed to be of a religious heritage before they came into the church. And you could tell them all the reasons why it would be bad to do, and we've done this in the past. You know, we looked at the pagan origins of something, and we say, oh, this is terrible for this reason and that reason. But, you know, it's kind of like dieting, isn't it? You know, these are things I should eat. These are things I should not eat. These things will make me healthy. These things will make me sick. And yet, everybody knows these things, and yet the fast food restaurants are full every lunchtime. People know better, but there's a pull that they can't resist. There's something about it that they just say, maybe tomorrow I'll worry about my diet. And Christmas is much the same way. We can look just about everywhere that Christmas was inspired and tell them that it's terrible. It has terrible meanings behind it. They don't mind because they want what they want. Some Christian groups go out of their way to point out what's bad about surrounding the holiday, the materialism that seems to take over this holiday, the fact that many of the things that people spend their time on, like my family, for my family it was Santa Claus, it was the Christmas tree, it was the lights on the house. That's what Christmas was when I was growing up. It wasn't about the birth of Christ. It wasn't about the message that God was sending a king to the earth. And so many Christians are trying to address this in their congregations. So how do we approach the subject? When we're questioned by a thoughtful person, what goes through our mind? You know, when I was growing up in the church, I remember not wanting to discuss my faith. Because, especially when you were a kid, and you tell somebody that you do something that's different, generally you get picked on. If you're a kid and you tell them, oh yeah, I go to church on Saturday instead of Sunday, they look at you like you're some kind of weirdo. And they'll generally tell you that. They don't seem to mind holding back. So there may be an apprehension to want to go out and start talking to people about your faith. Maybe it's your boss. Maybe it's your teacher. So where do we begin? Where do we begin? Do we start with the 4,000 years of Christmas? Do we lead off with the story of the Holy Day and the meanings of them? How do we tackle such a complex topic? You know, I chose the title Coping with the Magic of Christmas because I believe that we have to realize that there are forces at work beyond the fact that the world has simply been deceived. There are forces at work actively trying to thwart our efforts in trying to tell people the truth. We all know the scripture in Ephesians 6:12 that says, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." We know this. The God of this world is out there not just deceiving the world once and for all, but the God of this world is out there actively trying to deceive the world. We see that we have our work cut out for us. Turn over to Romans 12, and let's read a very familiar verse that many can recite from memory, and let's see how it relates to this topic. Romans 12. We've read this so many times, and it can relate in our lives so many different ways. It's one of these proof texts that come up when somebody's trying to prove a point here or there. Romans 12, and in verse 2. And it says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Now, I was looking for a different scripture when I came across that, and what caught my eye wasn't the words of that, because I've heard it so many times. You know, when you see memory verses, you see them again and again, and you think, okay, I know what that means, and you kind of move on. But in the program I was using to pull the scriptures up, it has the parallel verses. And I caught a glimpse of some words from the New Living Translation, and that's what really caught my eye. So reading the same verse again from the New Living Translation is quite interesting. It says, "Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think, that you will know what God wants you to do, and you will know how good and pleasing and perfect His will really is." See, it comes down to kind of like that topic of dieting we were talking about earlier. You got to change your way of thinking. If you don't, you'll never overcome those desires that we have to go and eat the bad food. You have to really think about what goes into our motivations and say, God is trying to create a new person in us. We talked about this before. This brand new person that thinks a different way, the way that God does. And that's what really stood out to me when I read this. You know, I believe there's a lot of magic associated with Christmas, but not the kind of magic always portrayed in movies like Miracle on 34th Street, It's a Wonderful Life, or A Christmas Carol. You know, there's a lot of programs that come on in this festival of Christmas and some of the other days here, and there's always little hints of miracles all through some of these programs. And there are some stories from history where we look at where on the battlefield opposing sides would lay down their arms for a 24-hour period, and on Christmas they'd come together and set aside their differences. And some people say that's the true spirit of Christmas. And somebody asks themselves, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with wanting that in your life? Why is that a bad thing? What would you say to them? Would you say, oh, that's evil? Wanting to put aside your differences, oh, you don't want to go there. You got to harbor those. There are things about the holiday, that are not as horrible as maybe you've thought in your back of your mind, oh, it's all terrible. It leads you just in the worst possible way. And, of course, this is all part of Satan's plan, to mix a little good with a little bad so that it doesn't seem that terrible. Christmas has much of this kind of magic associated with it. And, you know, I was thinking, as an example, I would come up and do a magic trick. I thought, this would be good to show kind of an example of what I'm talking about with the magic of Christmas. And so I got on the internet, and I was looking at a number of different magic tricks that I might try, and I thought, well, obviously probably an easiest one to do would be a card trick. So I got one evening, I just spent a couple hours trying to do some of these card tricks, and they show you how to do them. I mean, there's no miracles involved in most magic, you know. If there are any miracles at all, it comes down to some of the stuff we read in the Bible where it talks about sorcerers, and the kinds of miracles that you get in that kind of magic don't come from God. But the magic we see magicians on TV that pretty impressive, it's all sleight of hand. It's all based on deception. And they would show a magic trick from the front, and it looks, wow, how do they do that? Then they show the same trick from the back. That's not even the same trick. You're thinking, that can't even be the same camera angle, because you can see how deceptive what he's doing with those cards is. And I realize, I can't do this. My mind doesn't work this way. And I don't have the dexterity to tell you. But the thing is, you look at enough of these tricks, and what you find out is they are all just that. They are tricks. They're there to deceive, make you think one thing when the opposite is true. And then it's that context that I'm focusing on of the magic of Christmas. It mesmerizes. And no matter how many times people know that what the magician is doing is false, they still pay money every year to see somebody fool them because they like it. It's exciting. You know, I remember moving to Arizona when I was a little kid, back when we still kept Christmas. And I remember asking my folks, now, we don't have a chimney on our apartment. Now, I don't know if I was 6 or 7 years old at the time, but I remember asking my folks, how is Santa going to get into the house? Because we don't have a chimney. And I said, oh, he has a magic key, they told me. Well, there's my parents. They're not here to defend themselves. But he has a magic key, and he can get into anybody's apartment complex. And, of course, I bought it. 1 year, I remember, to this day I remember, standing up on my bed, looking out the window all night. I was going to get a glimpse of Santa's sleigh flying across the night sky. And I stayed up all night. And, of course, I was disappointed. But, of course, the disappointment doesn't last long when you run out the next morning and there's all these presents lying around. And one of my most vivid memories of a Christmas morning was getting up. I was the first one up. Might have even been that year. I don't remember. And I walked out into the living room. It was all dark. And the lights of the tree were on, but that wasn't enough to light everything up. And I stepped on something and heard a big crack. And, you know, a commotion brought some of the family out and went out there. What I'd done is I'd stepped on my brother's brand new train set, and I broke it. Now, you think, you know, with the spirit of the season, with all the thing that Christmas is supposed to instill in each of us, I would have been filled with remorse. But, you know, to this day, I remember being jealous that he got a better gift than me. I got a car set, he got a train set, and everybody knows trains beat cars every time. And even though he had a broken train set next to me, I wasn't sorry. I was mad. And my parents tried to get me to feel bad and apologize, and I'm sure I did so reluctantly. Oh, I have no memory of that. But whatever spirit of Christmas I was supposed to pick up during those early impressionable years never worked for me. When I was 10, we started keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And I remember being really embarrassed trying to tell the kids at school that I was going to the feast, because what kind of word is feast to tell kids about? I mean, amusement park, that sounds something the kids would be excited about, but feast, it's a weird name. And I wouldn't tell my teachers about it. I'd have my mom write me a note. And 10 years old, I remember giving my teachers this note. And then I wouldn't want to make eye contact with them, because then they might want to ask me about it, and I didn't want to have them ask me about it in front of the other kids, because then I'd be embarrassed telling them about it. And, of course, I'd have notes to get me out of the Christmas pageant or the Halloween activity or any of the other things of Valentine's Day. And, you know, nowadays, you know, I think we're smarter about some things, and when there's a party going on at school, we just say, you know, we're going to bring, you know, our daughter home, you know, half the day. There's no sense of being there for that. And they're fine with it. But I remember as a kid having to go to the office and sit there while all the kids were in the room doing whatever activity. And boy, they thought I was strange for not wanting to be there with them. And I felt strange. You know, kids can be really mean if they put their mind to it. And I remember each year being told what a weirdo I was for not doing the fun stuff of Christmas. One kid saying, boy, if my parents had let me keep Christmas, I'd run away from home. And I thought, what do you say to that? How do you respond to that? Is there? Oh, well, this is what you say, and that's going to shut them up. Sometimes there just isn't a good answer. And sometimes you take your lumps. Turn over to Matthew 5, Matthew 5. It's really hard when you have to tell your kids that sometimes they're going to take some lumps, whether it's physical lumps or just mental lumps of kids that will tease them and tell them that they're not like everyone else. And kids, let's face it, kids just want to be normal. They want to be like everybody else. They don't want to stand out. Matthew 5, starting in verse 12 through 16, it says, "Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Great is our reward because you are being persecuted among great company. A lot of people better than us were persecuted before us. And so we're among great company, the fact that sometimes we take lumps for the word of God. And it says in verse 13, "And you are the salt of the earth, but the salt loses its flavor. How shall it be seasoned?" You think, well, what does this mean? "It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." And then it says, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand so it gives light to all those in the house." What are they saying here? They're saying we've been given something special. Salt is special because it has the ability to do what it does to flavor food. Light is special because it has the ability to shine through the darkness and prevent people from stumbling. And it says here, if you're not going to do that, if you're not going to be part of that goodness that you've been called to do, then what good can we possibly do in this life? And it says here in verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." This is what it's all about. This is what I didn't get when I was 10 years old. I started to get it as I got older, but I got a late start. I started in the church at 10 years old. You know, when I graduated college, I really started to take responsibility for my spiritual life. Started a little bit in high school, but I really did when I got out of college, because you get married and now there's nobody to write you a note. I wasn't going to ask my wife to write me a note to get me out of the feast at work. You need to take a stand if you're going to grow spiritually. And so I took a stand. I remember one of the first stands I took was about the Sabbath. And I did this even after high school and before college. And I remember those years of, I worked at this place that worked Saturdays. And they only worked half a day on Saturday. But I remember telling them that, nope, not going to work that half a day of Saturday, but I'll work the other days. And I expected them not to give me the job, and for whatever reason they did, and I was glad. And I worked there a couple different years while I went through college. And each year I'd get the job back at the same place during the summer, and I'd work there again. And when I finally got through with college, I started there working there full time. So they definitely knew that I didn't work Saturdays, and it had never been a problem. Well, all of a sudden, there was a particular inventory that was going to happen on a Saturday, and they said, no exceptions, this is mandatory, everybody has to be there. And I said, you know what, I took a stand, and I'm gonna have to stick with this. I'm not going to go back and do this one time, because once I give a little inch here, I'm going to be giving it an inch over and over the rest of my life. So I took a stand and said, oh, no, I'm not going to work that day. And the very next week, I was laid off. They got rid of me. And, of course, they tried really hard to not to make it something, to choose their words carefully so that I wouldn't have a lawsuit. And I just realized that, you know, sometimes you get persecuted for righteousness' sake, and I moved on. It was 1 month before I was supposed to get married. And it was a really tough time, and I thought, wow, what a tough trial this is. And then right after I got married, I got a great job, better than I had before. And I've never been tested with the Sabbath like that again. It's like you take a stand, you take your ownership for who you are inside, and then God makes it better for you in the future. God wants us to take a stand for our beliefs. He wants us to give the answer to those people and to plant those seeds. We don't know where those seeds are going to land, We don't know if somebody's going to say, wow, what you told me is really interesting. It really made me think. We don't know if what we say is going to be mocked and we're going to take some more lumps. We just don't know. God says some of the seeds he casts are on rocky ground. Sometimes they're along the side of the road and they take root for a short time and then they wither. And sometimes they grow. And God wants us to be a part of that process. Whether we're in school, whether we're in college, whether we're at a job somewhere, that's what he called us to do. You know, if I could go back and do it all again, I think I would be glad to tell my teacher myself with confidence about my beliefs. If children made fun of me, I would remember what Jesus said when he was being crucified to save the very people who were trying to kill him. They were yelling at him. They were making fun of him. They were spitting on him. And the only thing on his mind right then was to pray and to say, forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they do. I mean, if he can take lumps like that, then we can take lumps. So how do we approach this topic when we're ready to step out on faith? The first thing to do is to look at the sincerity of the person who's asking the question. I mean, the Bible says don't cast your pearls before swines. If somebody's just looking to take a shot at you, it probably wouldn't do any good to go up there and say, try to start giving them a sermon. But if somebody is sincere, we don't want to shy away from that opportunity. You know, there's an article that a Christian group, that a pro-Christmas Christian group put out on Christmas, talking about the problems with the day. And it's pretty much a pretty good lead-in when you're talking to somebody that Christians today are realizing that there's a lot about this day that isn't right. Of course, this Christian group doesn't go out and condemn Christmas, but it's sort of like a icebreaker. It's an interesting topic. I'm going to read some of it from here, and it says, the origin of Christmas through traditions and controversies. For today's Christians, the origin of Christmas is and should be the birth of Jesus Christ as recorded from the Bible. Nothing more, nothing less. However, what we witness on December 25th each year has absolutely nothing to do with that blessed day, which probably occurred in late summer or early fall about 2,000 years ago. In fact, most of the customs and traditions of Christmas actually predate the birth of Christ, and many of them are downright deceptive in their meaning and origin. Here are a few examples. The date of December 25th originated with the ancient birthday of the sun god Mithra, a pagan deity whose religious influence became widespread in the Roman Empire during the first few centuries. Mithra was related to the Semitic sun god Shamash. Now, Semitic is another word for saying from a Babylonian background, from the land of Canaan. Semitic god Shamash and his worship spread throughout Asia and Europe, where he was called Das Sol Invictus Mithra, which is the unconquered sun. Rome was well known for absorbing pagan religions and rituals in its widespread empire. As such, Rome converted the pagan legacy and celebration of the god Saturn and rebirth of the sun god during the winter solstice period. The winter holiday became known as Saturnalia and began the week prior to December 25th. This festival was characterized by gift-giving, feasting, singing, and downright debauchery as a priest of Saturn carried wreaths and evergreen boughs in the procession throughout the Roman temple. So what this is saying here is all of these things that we trace back and we read, oh, yeah, that Christmas is about Mithra, and they mention things that don't appear to be in our Bible. So even though we know they're kind of bad, we don't know what that was all about, but at least they weren't doing something against what God says in this book. What it's saying here is the Romans were really good at taking something that was older than they are, repackaging it, and relabeling it, selling it again on the stores as a fresh product. So what they're saying is these things went back long before Rome, and as many writers have realized. The true origin of Christmas is filled with controversies and compromise. A quick study will reveal a number of disturbing roots that we haven't had time to cover in this brief article. In short, the Christmas holiday we celebrate today is indicative of Christianity's willingness to absorb the world's customs and traditions. Now, what does God tell us to do? God tells us to come out of this world. Do not be conformed. We read that earlier. Do not be conformed by this world. And it says right here, the Christian faith is readily admitting that they have a willingness to absorb the world's customs and make it a part of their own. And Christmas should be nothing more than the simple observance of Jesus Christ. A wonderful reminder of Christ's humble beginning and the human child of this world. His birth merely set the stage for the glory, power, and salvation that would be revealed in his life, death, and resurrection. Whether it's December 25th or sometime in late December or September, or any other day of the year, we should see and use each and every opportunity to reflect on Jesus Christ and his message for hope for all of us. This is sort of their get-out-of-jail-free card. Yeah, it's really terrible. All these things are bad. We want you to be aware of it. But as long as you're in the back of your mind thinking, this is for God, I'm doing this for God, then that's sort of your get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, in the end, it tells every reader to take the opportunity to focus on Christ. And there's nothing wrong with those words. We should take every opportunity in our lives to focus on Jesus Christ and his message of hope, because the Holy Days teach us this very clearly. And if you really want to study up on some of the proofs that Jesus wasn't born on December 25th, there's a lot of work out there. I don't have time to cover it today. In fact, many of the things I'm covering, I'm just going over so lightly because it's really kind of two sermons today. One is coping with Christmas in one respect, and the other is really taking a look at what's behind Christmas that we have to cope with. And the reason I chose them both together instead of giving either one of them the full sermon was I feel that you kind of need one to do the other. If you're going to have a position in your head made up about how I feel about this day, what does it really mean to me, and be able to give a thoughtful answer, you kind of have to know what's behind Christmas. And the good news every year in December runs a story or two on the holiday. There was some stories this year about the origins, similar to what I was reading already. A few years back, there was an article talking about setting the date for Christ's birth. And, you know, we always think about the fact that the shepherds were out in the fields and therefore it couldn't have been winter. There's a lot of evidence that point to a Feast of Tabernacles or near Feast of Tabernacles, birthday. And I think it's an interesting study to go through, and I think it would help to bolster your faith to go through and study some of those. And if anyone would like to know where the articles are online, I can help you with those later. So if Christianity knows that Christmas was not about Christ, why do they do it? Well, originally the reason was taking a pagan festival that appealed to the masses and adopting this and making it a part of your own, and then trying to take ownership of it. Believe it or not, it's a trick that the Christians learned from the Romans, and Microsoft learned from them. Microsoft has this doctrine that got them in court called embrace and enhance. And what they do is they'll take some technology that doesn't belong to them, they'll make it a little bit different, so it only works in their operating system, and then they put it out there, you have to have this if you really want to work your computer. And this embrace and enhance is what the original Christians did, what they learned from the Romans. Take something that belonged to somebody else. Everybody was all caught up in it. They all had the parties and the wonderful time. Change it around, make it your own, and then sell it as your own product. In his book, 4,000 Years of Christmas, Dr. Earl Count cites a letter from the Catholic apostle to the Germans, to the Pope. And this letter came out about 400 years after the Catholic Church started keeping Christmas. So the Catholic Church started keeping it around 330 so AD, 400 years after that. This letter comes to the Pope, and he's complaining. Dr. Count relates, there exists a letter from the year 742 AD in which Saint Boniface complains to Pope Zacharias that his labors to convert the Germanic tribes were being handicapped by the escapades of the Christians back in Rome. The tribes were on the threshold of becoming Christians, but their conversion was being retarded by the enjoyment of lurid carnivals. When Boniface tried to turn them away from such customs, they argued that they had seen them celebrate under the very shadow of St. Peter's in Rome. Embarrassed and sorry, Pope Zacharias replied, admitting that the people in the city of Rome behave very badly at Christmas time. So, the idea here was to bring pagans out of their pagan customs and give them Christ. And to do so by adopting their days, giving them new meanings, and allow them to come into the church. And here we see that the Christians that started as Christians in Rome were actually going backwards. So not only were they not being able to convert the pagans into Christianity and remove these symbols, you certainly couldn't stop the Christians from using them who adopted them because they were so much fun. So over the past few years, I've been studying on this subject, and lately I've had this kind of new sense of vigor because I had this idea that we always point, and that Christianity today is pretty open about pointing back to the time of Christ and sort of the problems and debauchery that went on with the festivals that later became Christmas. But I thought, you know, it's pretty clear in the Old Testament what God tells his people to do and what not to do. And in the past, modern-day Christians say, well, that's the Old Covenant, and the New Covenant's different. So whatever happened back there is there, and whatever happened up here is now, and, you know, there's no linkage between the two. And I thought, I bet you there is. I mean, we know there is, but I bet you there's linkage that I can pull together and tie the two together. You know, historians today have a difficult time accepting much of the history of the Bible before the recorded history because when you think about it, the Bible teaches that Adam lived like 900 years and Noah lived like 900 years. Historians today can't wrap their mind around that. And so when they start going back in time, they start saying, well, we're watching the population of the earth decrease, and based upon that, this tells us something. But then they find evidence of things that are they don't understand, and they decide, well, the earth has to be really old because we know that the earth is billions of years old. So that means people had to have existed, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago. And so I was finding some websites that were tracking the global population back. And you get back to about 4,000 years before Christ, which would be about the time of Adam. And they put the world population at 5 million. And then you go back 1,000 years before that, and it says the population is stable at about 5 million. You go back 3,000 years before that, and it says the population is stable about 5 million. For so, whatever reason, the population was decreasing as you're going back toward the beginning of civilization, and then all of a sudden, for about 5,000 years, historians say, population stayed at about 5 million. No explanation why. And the evidence that they have was based upon some theory somebody wrote in some book. And the farther back you go, the less you really understand about what happened. The other thing I noticed that historians have a trouble with is that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. Moses led the children of Egypt out, the children of Israel out of Egypt around 1400 B.C., we have history going back before that. They've pulled up hieroglyphics, cuneiform, and other works going back over 1,000 years before that. And so what historians do is they look at some of these ancient histories that were recorded before the Bible was written, and they said, wow, I see patterns here. I see things that the Bible says was theirs, and this was going on in some of these ancient cultures. Therefore, they conclude, the Bible is the counterfeit. Since the Bible was written after, let's say, Hammurabi's code was, which has a lot of the elements of the Ten Commandments in it, therefore, the Bible must be the counterfeit. And this really bothered me, and I thought, there's got to be some truth that I can pull out of what history is out there. And I really started looking. Mr. Walker got me started in the right direction by quoting Revelation 13:8. Revelation 13:8 has a very interesting phrase in it. It says, "All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." And this phrase, "from the foundation of the world," really intrigued me. I did a word search on the phrase, and it came up about 9 different times. And when I went through some of these, it was interesting how the different parts of God's plan was talked about from the foundation of the world. In Hebrews 9:26, it says, "He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." So here we talk about Christ's sacrifice for the remission of sins being known about from the foundation of the world. In Hebrews 4:3, it says, "For we who have believed do enter that rest." What rest are we talking about? We're talking about salvation here. "Do enter that rest. As he said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world." So the plan of salvation for mankind was there since the foundation of the world. And in Luke 11:50, it says that the blood of all the prophets which were shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation. So if God's plan was written from the foundations of the world, and Lucifer, before he turned into Satan, was the first ruler of this world and given God's charge of this place, the odds of Lucifer knowing about God's plan for mankind from the foundation of the earth is pretty good. First thing, all I got to do is find proof of it. So if Satan deceived the whole world, including their worship system, where did it begin? Well, we all know that the world got off track in the Garden of Eden. And we've read it so many times. And if you look at 2 Corinthians 11:3-4, we'll just see a slight reference to that where everything kind of got off track. In 2 Corinthians 11:3-4, in the New Living Translation it says, but this is Paul talking to the Corinthians, "But I fear that somehow you will be led away from your pure and simple devotion to Christ, just as Eve was deceived by the serpent. You seem to believe whatever anyone tells you, even if they preach about a different Jesus than the one we preach, a different spirit from the one you received, or a different kind of gospel than the one you believed." So we're here talking about a duplicate system that exists. And Paul is warning them that some of these people are falling prey to this duplicate system that started just as Eve was deceived by the serpent. A few weeks ago, David Love talked a great deal about the first lie, and I really appreciated that he recognized that we always just look at Satan's first lie as, oh, that's the first lie, we know that, we can move on. But Satan was very crafty. And what he said to her caused her to stumble. He used simple misdirection. He said, "You will not surely die." She was focusing on the word surely. She thought, "If I eat that, I'm dropping dead." Satan says, "You eat that, you're not going to drop dead." And guess what? Satan was right. So it appeared on the surface that God was the one that was lying. This is where this new religion, this other gospel, got started. This idea that what we've all been told by the prophets is wrong. That there's this other way that we can look at things that has a better message. You know, I read so many different excerpts. Some of the textbooks that I was looking at are very academic in the way they're written. They're written at a level probably 5 years over what I'm comfortable reading. And so I read over, and you would have to piece sentence fragments together. And so I'm not going to do a lot of reading from a lot of the different sources. I have a few that I'm going to read from today. But over all of the resources that I did read, I found a lot of agreement in tying the pagan worship that we see talked about when we look at the history of Christmas and what we see when we trace that back through back to the Garden of Eden. There is a work put out by the Messianic Jewish organization that I think did a pretty good job of combining a lot of these sources, a lot of the ones I've already read. From one of the books is a fabulous book, The Two Babylons. It uses some of the works from there, plus some works from some other sources here. And I thought I'd read this because it flows better than some of the verbiage in some of these books, that the sentences are broke up with putting their proof in the middle of the sentence, and it gets kind of hard to follow. So from the Messianic Jewish organization here, it said, "The celebration of Christmas is not biblical. Christmas has pagan origin. In ancient times, the winter solstice was celebrated in Babylon as the birthday of Tammuz." So here they point Christmas not back to Roman times, but back to Babylon. And this is getting back to the Old Testament, where we read about God telling people how they should and shouldn't conduct themselves. "This was the shortest day of the year in the latter part of December. According to the pagans, the god Nimrod visited the evergreen tree and left gifts upon it. This festival became known as Saturnalia. On this day, friends and family would exchange gifts." And as I remember getting up every single morning on Christmas morning, the trees were under the tree. The presents were under the tree. And on the if you had a hearth, you might have stockings hung there, and there might be evergreen boughs decorating your hearth or maybe your front door. And that's where these things come from. Interestingly, the winter solstice was already celebrated by followers of Mirtha as the nativity or birthday of the unconquered sun. Mithra was the Persian sun god, and his worship was widespread throughout the Roman Empire in the days of the early believers. So it was this pagan, this Persian sun god that was readopted by the Romans and relabeled Saturn. Mithra was not the only pagan deity said to be born at this time of the year. Osiris, Horus, these are from Egypt, of course. Hercules, Bacchus, Adonis, Jupiter. Some of these things you've heard from Greek and Roman mythology. And Tammuz, we already read, and other sun gods were supposedly born on this time of the year in the winter solstice. Many very ancient writings out of Egypt tell of King Osiris and Queen Isis and their son Horus. These originated from about 3000 BC. After the untimely death of King Osiris, Isis began the myth of the ever-living spirit of Osiris. According to the legend, Osiris was reborn through Horus, and the son, who was born to Isis much after the death of her husband, became King Osiris once again. And I find it interesting that when you study the history of Nimrod, the exact same story exists. Nimrod and his wife, Semiramis, set themselves up as a worship in ancient Babylon. And Nimrod had an untimely death. Afterwards, long after his death, his wife became with child, and she didn't want to be stoned for adultery, so she told everyone she was miraculously conceived, and it was her husband going to be reborn in her. The exact same story out of Egypt we see in Babylon. Alexander Hilsop, in his book The Two Babylons, says that Christmas was originally a pagan festival is beyond all doubt. The time of the year and the ceremonies with which it is still celebrated prove its origin. In Egypt, the sun is son of Isis, the Egyptian title for Queen of Heaven, was born at this very time. We know that Semiramis, Nimrod's wife, was called the Queen of Heaven and actually worshipped in ancient Israel, much to God's upsetness. The very name by which the Christians Christmas is popularly known among ourselves, Yule Day, proves at once its pagan and Babylonian origin. Yule is a Chaldee name for infant or little child, and is And as the 25th of December was called by our pagan Anglo-Saxon ancestors, Yule Day, or the Child's Day, and the night preceded it was Mother's Night, long before that they came in contact with Christianity. That sufficiently proves the real character far and wide in the realms of paganism, that this is what the birthday observance was all about. When the feast was celebrated in Rome, it was called the Festival of Saturn and lasted for 5 days. In both ancient Rome and more ancient Babylon, the festival is characterized by bouts of drunkenness, wild merrymaking, and lascivious orgies, which begin with an innocent kiss under the mistletoe and would then lead to justification of all sorts of excesses and abominations. Hilsop notes that the winter solstice was also the birthday of the Queen of Heaven. Long before the 4th century, and long before the Christian era itself, a festival was celebrated among the heathen at this precise time of year in honor of the birth and the son of the Babylonian Queen of Heaven, and it may fairly be presumed that in order to conciliate the heathen, to swell the numbers of nominal adherents to Christianity, the same festival was adopted by the Roman Church, giving it only the name of Christ. This tendency on the part of Christians to meet paganism halfway was very well developed. And so he goes on and on talking about that. And one last thing here, it made its way into Northern European under the name Odin, which is the Scandinavian sun god. And in that culture, the evergreen tree was a sacred to Odin, and the people decorated it during the festival of Saturnalia, and legend has it that Odin would bestow Yuletide gifts on those who approached the sacred fir tree. I know I sure looked for those sacred gifts when I got up on Christmas morning. So, of course, to us who've grown up in the church, some of these things are nothing new. We've heard them over and over again. But I read these because they lay a breadcrumb trail to what I'm trying to get to. It's interesting, the point of view, the author here in the Two Babylons, he's comparing the ancient Babylonian Empire of Nimrod with what the Revelation calls the Babylonian Empire of the end time. And these are the two Babylons that he is comparing to one another. And in his study, and he has got literally hundreds and hundreds of different sources here, it goes on and on and on for all the different sources that he is pulling from. He talks about what he was finding as he read. And it was a very interesting metaphor that he brings up that I'd like to read. And he says here in his introduction, "There is a great difference between the works of men and the works of God. That the same minute and searching investigation which displays the defects and imperfections of one brings out the beauties of the other. If the most finely polished needle on which the art of man has been expended be subject to a microscope, many inequalities, much roughness, and much clumsiness will be seen." Have you ever got a chance to see an electron microscope? You look at something that looks perfect. When you blow it up, it looks terrible. It just looks so rough and so broken when you actually blow it up and see it. So the most finely polished man-made object under even a simple microscope, not even an electron microscope, shows all of these imperfection and clumsiness, and they'll be clearly seen. But if the microscope be brought to bear on the flowers of the field, no such result appears. Instead of their beauty diminishing, new beauties, and still more delicate, that they have escaped the naked eye and forthwith discovered. Beauties that make us appreciate, in a way which otherwise we could not have had little conception of, the full force of the Lord's saying when he says, "Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon, with all of his glory, was not arrayed like one of these." It's a poetic thing to say, but it's true. Because when you look at Solomon as king, with all of the gold and all the splendor and all of the majesty that he had, when you started looking into Solomon, there was flaws, his vanity, and the way he kept the faith. But yet you open up a flower, and the deeper you go, the more beautiful and the more intricate it gets. The same law appears also in comparing the Word of God and the most finished productions of men. There are spots and blemishes in the most admired productions of the human genius. But the more the Scriptures are searched, the more minutely they are studied, the more the perfection appears. New beauties are brought into light every day, and the discoveries of science, the researchers of the learned, and the laborers of the infidels all alike conspire to illustrate the wonderful harmony of all the parts and the divine beauty that clothes the whole world. So, I really appreciate his point of view. And this is the kind of the labor of love that he spent studying all of the different sources, looking. There's a section where he talks about, where he ties all of the different pagan religions together. And basically, his point is this. The cradle of civilization leads back to Babylon, when Nimrod brought all the people together. And then the languages were confounded and they were scattered. And when they were scattered, they took that which he built into the different corners of the world. And that is why they all have elements of the exact same belief system within their midst. He says, if there be this general coincidence between the systems of Babylon and Rome, the question arises, does the coincidence stop there? To answer this, far otherwise, we have only to bring the ancient Babylonian mysteries to bear on the whole system of Rome, and then it will be seen how immensely that one has borrowed from the other. These mysteries were long shrouded in darkness, but now the thick darkness begins to pass away. All who have paid the least attention to the literature of the Greece, of Egypt, of Phoenicia, and of Rome are aware of the place in which the mysteries occupy in these countries, and that whatever circumstantial diversities might be, it all essentially respects these mysteries in the different countries where they are all the same. Now, as the language of Jeremiah already quoted, which indicates that Babylon was the primeval source of which all of these systems of idolatry flowed, so the deductions of the most learned historians on mere historical grounds have led to the same conclusion. So he's talking about secular historians. When you start reading all the secular histories, and as I was showing you in the bibliography there, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of them. And when you start looking at all of them, you begin to see that the science of mathematics was traced back to Babylon, where in Babylon it was treated as a religion. The science of astronomy was traced in all these cultures back to Babylon, where it was treated as a religious belief. And therefore, you cannot escape the fact that any religious institutions that Babylon would have had would have also made its way into the different cultures. He goes on to say, the statement of, and he mentions some names here, of some of the people that he has studied here, both Bunsen and Layard in their researches have come to the substantially same result. The statement of Bunsen is to the effect that the religious system of Egypt was derived from Asia and the primitive empire of Babel. Layard, again, though taking a somewhat more favorable view of the system of the Chaldean Magi, said, I'm persuaded that the facts of history warrant, nevertheless, thus speaks of that system, of the great antiquity of this primitive worship, there are abundant evidence that it originated among the inhabitants of the Assyrian plains. We have the united testimony of sacred and profane history. So even somebody who didn't agree with the idea that it all came from Babylon had to admit that when you looked at all of the history that's out there, it all points back, all of the paganism that the world's Christianity agrees came from Roman times, worked their way back to Babylon, where we have plenty of research in the Old Testament that talks about it. He goes on and talks about and paints a picture of what happened from the time of the Garden of Eden until the time of Nimrod, and that the way the Babylonians looked at the Garden of Eden was that it wasn't a situation where two people failed based upon a lie. The way they looked at it was that there was this God that told them they had to do certain things that were hard things to do. They were obviously hard because they failed. A serpent came along and told them there was an easier way, that you don't have to follow the rules. And there is a way you can get all that knowledge that that tree of life that has been holding you back can offer. Some of the earliest worship symbols that he found shows the picture of a serpent and a picture of the sun. The serpent being the great enlightener of religion, where the sun was a great enlightener of the physical world. When God saw the corruption in the world, he destroyed it with a great flood. When he did that, he changed the rules. And he decided that he was going to do things differently. If you turn over to Romans 1, we'll read why God felt this was necessary. Romans 1. It tells us that the people, before the languages were confounded, had the knowledge of God. And it also tells us how God felt about what they did not understand. And this is something that I guess gets by a lot of Christians today, because this is obviously from the New Testament. This was there for them to understand, but yet they don't understand. In Romans 1, and starting in verse 18 through 25, starts off, "For the wrath of God," so lest there be any confusion of what God feels about what he's about to say, "the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of man, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them." So that's the first thing. God showed man at one point who and what he was. And when did he do this? In verse 20, "Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." God is talking about those people from Adam all the way through to Noah, and even on beyond, because Noah preached the righteousness the same as those that came before. And in verse 21, "Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of incorruptible God to the image made like corruptible man." The Babylonians first deified Nimrod. And in their religious system that they built, they deified even going back to Adam and Eve. And they deified the physical creation of birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. It's one of the things that we see in every one of these mystery systems, from Egypt, from Babylon to Assyria, into the Greece, Persian, Phoenician, Roman. All of these systems all have certain things in common. They worship the physical ground, the physical animals, the physical creation. They worship the sun. They worship the creation, but not the creator. "Therefore God gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie." Now that really stood out to me. The word "the," not "a." They didn't exchange the truth of God for a lie. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie. And I started thinking, what is the lie? Well, it becomes very clear what the lie is. So this was the heart of what the mystery system was. Worship the creation, not the creator, based on the lie. So down in Ezekiel 18, we read that there is a reference to one of these false gods that are mentioned. And it says, this is in the time of Ezekiel and Jeremiah, He brought me to the north gate in the Lord's temple, and some of the men were sitting there, some of the women were sitting there, weeping for the god Tammuz. This is one of those Babylonian religions that we talked about earlier and read that some realize is at the heart of what Christmas is all about. And when you start piecing all these pieces together and you start reading all this literature, it starts to become very clear. After the flood, God steps out of the picture. He told Noah that from now on, man would have to rule man. If somebody kills somebody, then man would have to take that person's life. Before that, God was in charge. God would administer the government on earth. After that time, based upon what we read there earlier and why God chose to step out of the picture, they knew him, they rejected him. So he says, from now on, you guys are on your own. God also changed the lifespan of man to 120 years, something that historians can't wrap their minds around today. And lastly, God changed the nature of the animals. When the animals were on the ark, they were not tearing each other up because, like we read in the world tomorrow, the leopard is going to lie down with the same animals that eat grain and straw, and their nature will be changed back to what they were. So what we see here is a world where, after the flood, things became very difficult. People didn't live as long. There was dangerous animals all afoot. The animals were going after villages and hurting people. And along comes Nimrod on the scene as this great warrior hunter, and he was protecting the people. He also organized the people into cities. And in the cities, they could be protected behind walls. Before that, they didn't live in walled cities. So Nimrod put himself up as a savior of the people. And we look at when he dies, and the legends that go along out of the Egyptian writings and some of the other writings that are out there, Herodotus and others, paint this picture of Seth, one of Noah's children, or not Shem, excuse me, one of Noah's children, was actually responsible for killing Nimrod, cutting his body up and separating it and sending it to all the different nations on the earth, because he didn't want the people on the earth to keep believing that this guy was a god and that he should be worshipped in any way. And because of this, and because of this change of world opinion, the author states this is what drove the mystery system underground, where they started substituting images for what they were truly keeping. And it's how they were able to kind of fly under the radar. You know, we can take a look at the history here. And one of the things I think I was looking for really was the smoking gun. We've seen this story kind of progress here and kind of understand how this all came about. But I was really hoping for a smoking gun where this would tie in the fact that the Bible was the authoritative source and not the other way around that followed history. And I found what I think is a good example of a smoking gun in this book here. In the ancient Babylonian system, they had a number of goddesses that they worshipped. One of them was Eve from the Garden of Eden. And the interesting thing about it was Eve was somebody, you don't find her name in any of the writings, but there is a name which we know very clearly is talking about Eve. They worship a great goddess mother, or mother god, mother of gods and men. And the name that they had for her was a name, Thalatt, T-H-A-L-A-T-T-H. The word Thalatt in the Babylonian culture means the rib. And this goddess had a name which means the rib. And it comes from the verb thalah, which signifies to turn aside, to halt, or to walk sideways. So the Babylonian language had a word for rib which carried the meaning of to turn away and to walk sideways. This word was used to worship the goddess mother of mankind. Adam's name as her husband was Baal Thalat, or husband of the rib. Baal signifies Lord, but in the case of marriage, it means husband. But Baal Thalat, according to one particular Hebrew idiom, also means that he halted and went sideways. So this merely wasn't a story added to the Babylonian history. This is at the root of their language. If a word in their language has this meaning, then it wasn't just a story like we would use words to associate to some story. This was at the root of their culture. It shows us very clearly that they had a concept of who they were worshiping in their mystery system. It goes back to the Garden of Eden and to that lie that they believed, that there is a God out there, but he's the mean God. And we like the God that made it easy on us. We like the God that protected us. We like the God that built cities for us. We don't like that God that makes us do all these horrible things. We like the God that says, go ahead and carouse around and do all the things that you want to do. And that brings us to our final scripture here in Deuteronomy 12. In Deuteronomy 12. This system started by Satan, brought to man in the garden, and then turned into a religion in Babylon, is what is referred to in Deuteronomy 12, verses 30 through 32. And when we read this, you can't say, well, this is the old covenant, so God doesn't care anymore. Because God makes it very clear on how he feels about this system. This is the system that he talks about in the Revelation, and he's just as committed to his feelings toward this system as he ever was. And in Deuteronomy 12, at the birth of his nation, he tells them, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do so likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. There is no doubt here that he's not saying, I don't want you to worship their gods. He's saying, I don't want you to worship me the way they worship their gods. That is what God is saying here. It is very clear. Nothing in their worship system does God want associated with him in any way. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. So we get back to the original question. Why don't we keep the good parts of Christmas with somebody who asks us, when they are sincere? You know, the magic of Christmas was designed by Satan to be a counterfeit to the real celebration of God through his holy days. It has successfully deceived the world into not keeping the days God gives us. It has distracted them and made them go down a different path. The practices that embody Christmas are at the very heart of that mystery religion that God warns us about over and over. Most of all, shown by Deuteronomy 12, I would tell them I do not keep Christmas because it is offensive to God. And if it's offensive to God, then it offends me.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Now I'm going to get to take all you guys' gifts back and get my money back. Any gifts you have for me, I'll accept them as the end of the year gift. Let's turn the page. All right.